Hello, you're listening to Spoiler
Filled
Film
Conversation.
Hooray!
Hooray!
Woo!
Yeah!
Woo!
Yeah. Hello, I'm Richard Nicholas, and with me to have a podcast is Anthony Evans.
Hello.
And Jamie Thomas.
Hello.
And we are three of the members of Filmbin, a film podcast collective. Would you guys agree?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And we're very masculine today, it seems.
Well,
yes.
We are, because...
This,
ooh, more masculine than I am, I tell you. That was scary. But anyway, this week's film that we are here to discuss is Ravenous. And it was picked by Jamie. And he will give some of the details of the film for a bit of clarity as to what we're talking about.
Okay. Ravenous is from 1999... it's directed by Antonia Bird and written by Ted Griffin. Captain John Boyd's promotion stations him at a fort where a rescued man tells a disturbing tale of cannibalism. It stars Guy Pearce, Robert Carlyle, David Arquette, Jeremy Davis, Jeffrey Jones, John Spencer. Those are all the recognisable ones. mainly Guy Pearce and Robert Carlyle.
Mainly Robert Carlyle,
yeah. it's the standout.
Yeah. So, we usually discuss our expectations. Seeing as it was your pick, Jamie, why did you, you know, give us this film? What were you expecting from it when you saw it the first time?
I remember when it came out back in 99, there'd been a lot of trailers for it. And I'm not sure, I can't see anything about it now, but I was reasonably sure it was... one of those like Film 4 funded productions, Channel 4, the UK show that like Channel, they've got their Film 4 offshoot, and they would like fund smaller kind of indie films.
Hmm.
I'm sure I remember it, and it is one of those films that would be on like Channel 4 at 1 o'clock in the morning on a Friday.
Yeah.
And you just kind of end up watching it. But I never saw it, even though I've seen it talked about a lot online. And lots of people, like, praise it and say it's great. And it's kind of an undiscovered, like, a forgotten, like, gem. And then I finally watched it a couple of years ago. And I agree, for the most part. It was one of those films that is pretty much exactly what I was expecting when I watched it. Like, quirky, kind of weird, kind of funny.
Yeah, almost stepping into comedy at times, but not fully. Like, it isn't a comedy horror, I would say, but it's very much a black kind of drama horror film. You know, it starts off as a kind of, you know, Civil War era period drama that could, you know, not go anywhere horrific, but then it does. It takes a darker and darker and more bizarre turn as it goes on.
Yeah,
which is what the trailer sort of suggested. You know, it doesn't give the game away. I mean, but the trailer does give you a good clue as to where it's going. I think it was a bit too spoilery for me, because I think I would have rather have just come across this without knowing anything. And as you led through the story, you go, whoa, this is crazy.
Yeah.
And this is dark. And then it even, like, it's quite weird, because there's kind of stages throughout the film where you go, oh, this just got scary and dark. Oh, this got suddenly a bit weirder and more paranormal. Oh my gosh, what's going on now? And then, it, you know, it kind of escalates. There's lots of times where it kind of pulls the rug out where you think you know what's going on. But I think the trailer, for me, made it look intriguing, but a little bit, like, I kind of thought, based on the trailer, I suspected things were going to happen that then did, so I don't know. I don't know what that... But I was interested when I saw the trailer as well. Anthony, what about you?
Well, I vaguely remember seeing this film about, I don't know, it must be about 10 years ago now. And I didn't see all of it. It must have been, like, the first half, because that's, whilst rewatching it, that's all I could really remember. My memory of it was just that it was very odd.
Hmm.
And odd, but I enjoyed it. But I enjoy weird things, so that doesn't really say much about the quality of it. So, and the thing I remember most is just kind of really weird musical keys sometimes. And that's really all I could remember coming back into it. And this time, I think that kind of holds up as well this time, because, yes, it is a strange film, but kind of good, but kind of weird at the same time.
I think, like it's interesting. It's interesting you mentioned the music, because I was quite enthralled by the story, and then all of a sudden, like, I think it was Guy Pearce was walking through some snow after surviving some ordeal, and the music, you just suddenly start noticing it, and you're going, this music is so weird, and it's so unique, and kind of, I really liked it by the end, I got used to it, and it's like old-timey, but like also like a kind of professional score.
The music was done by Michael Nyman and Damon Albarn from
Blur
and Gorillaz. So it's and you like you can almost tell who handled which bits of the score, because you've got more kind of orchestral stuff and the atmospheric stuff, which comes presumably from Michael Nyman, and then you've got the weird stuff that is like Damon Albarn just like playing around with different instruments and trying to make. So it sounds like the music is deliberately trying to make you feel like really physically uncomfortable.
Yeah, but then it has like a feeling of like, because it's set at the Civil War era America, like it's got a sound of instruments and music from the time to it occasionally, but it's much more bizarre and like you say, it's an atmospheric music rather than a song most of the time.
Yeah, and I think on like you said, I do like the soundtrack. I think as like individually, just the music, I'd buy it as an album. And I think about 75% of the time, it's really effective and really unsettling.
Yeah,
but there are just a few moments where it's just a little bit distracting,
it takes
you out a little bit from the atmosphere that I think they were trying to go for.
The tension. And then,
yeah, and sometimes it's just a little bit too cheeky and comedic, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
It's just a bit odd.
I think that's what drew my attention, is for some moments it was a bit, this is incongruous. And yet, I think that's what I liked about it, is because I started noticing it, I started to enjoy the music more because it was so odd. It was just weird music to have for this tone of film, I rated it. I think it spiced up what could have been very normal visuals. Because in any Western, like, you're going to get a man traipsing through the snow covered in blood, or you know, you're going to get these scenes where people are walking through the forest or in a sort of shack. And when the music was there, it didn't seem like anything you'd seen before, because it was just working with the tension at times. Other times, maybe sticking out a bit, but I kind of liked it.
Thumbs up all round then.
Yeah.
The music is definitely divisive, though. That's one of the complaints that I've found about it most commonly, is the music is abrasive or distracting.
It was like just a few moments I found it a bit distracting, but overall I think it was pretty unique.
I'd go with it. I'd rather be unique than forgettable. So
yeah.
We don't usually talk about. I mean, we're not massive score chatters. We don't usually, you know, bang on about music that, unless it's part of the story. We're big story podcast fans, and so it's interesting we all started talking about the music first of all. But to concentrate on some of the story aspects a bit, then it explores a mythology from like North America, which I think one of the things it is about as a horror topic is the myth of the Wendigo. Is that how you say it?
Wendigo,
wiggity wiggity woo, whatever. The Wendigo, you're saying? No, Wendigo.
Wendigo.
Okay.
Or Wendigo, yeah, I don't know.
I think that myth actually has a lot of different spellings and pronunciations, but that myth I'd heard of before, because I have a casual interest in cryptozoology and mythology and things. And it's about people or beasts that turn, like, it's about people who turn to cannibalism and end up turn, like, it's not just they kind of almost get addicted to cannibalism and turn into kind of demonic monsters that, you know, get powered up by eating other humans. Yeah. I think the mythology, sometimes it's like quite a creepy demon monster that's sometimes attributed to having like a kind of antlers and a weird, like, more of a kind of animal quality to it. But it also, the myth encompasses stories of cannibalism going wrong. And this is that story, essentially, of, you know, cannibalism escalating into, you know...
I think it's... one of the things I like about it is that there is a supernatural... Robert Carlyle is essentially that monster, because he does... eating human flesh does have restorative effects in this film.
You kind of level up and heal.
Yeah, it brings Geoffrey Jones pretty much back to life.
Yeah, it was. And I found that a bit odd. Like I didn't know if it was necessary to have that kind of supernatural element to it. What do you guys think?
I think with Geoffrey Jones's character, because you know, essentially, we're going to talk straight about the spoilerific concept of the film, but Geoffrey Jones is at one point assumed dead. And when he comes back, it's because he's been healed up with this kind of supernatural quality. Like, it's essentially, it establishes the theory that if humans turn to cannibalism, it helps them heal and gives them, it doesn't give them powers, but it gives them, their health is, they're stronger from eating people. And it has a kind of power up thing where you heal better, doesn't it? It's like, it'll heal you and power you up. But it doesn't, you know, you don't, that's it. I mean, you just are stronger. And then you're kind of, sort of, have a sort of addiction to it that you kind of can't, an insatiable lust for food, for cannibalism, or you're just ravenous for human flesh, however you want to.
It has like a vampire aspect to it.
Yeah.
Like, that's how they play it. Like, they basically turn them into vampires, but they're not drinking blood, they're actually eating people.
Yeah, and with Robert Carlyle's character, he's essentially, his goal is twofold: keep himself alive and keep himself strong and healthy by, you know, basically making cannibalism a doable thing. Like, you know, he has to essentially kill people and consume them one way or the other. You know what I mean?
And like, get away with it.
And he's also maybe got more ambitious plans to create a kind of, they refer to it a bit as a cult, but a kind of
community.
A society of people who are like him. That he's, and Geoffrey Jones plays a character who is brought back from the brink of death and is partially converted. And like, it's interesting you bring that up, Anthony, because I thought that was one of the more sloppy elements of the story, because it's kind of meant to be a big surprise, and it is surprising, but I don't think it communicated how... Like, it seems silly that he could heal that quickly, isn't it?
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
It's just... I you know, I don't want to second-guess the film or anything. I just kind of felt like it was all very kind of realistic and naturalistic, that it would have been just a bit more effective if it played it a bit more straight, if you know what I mean. Like, it didn't really need that supernatural element. Well, it didn't need to confirm the supernatural element, at least.
And it maybe healed them too much. Like, some of the time, you know, the characters who've become cannibals, they have healed, and they heal almost to perfection, rather than, you know, like, surviving and being... Like, it should perhaps have been a more subtle healing. Or maybe just the fact that they're surviving, they're attributing to cannibalism, when in fact that's not actually true, they're just fortunate. So it could have been, you know, you might heal quickly from a bullet wound, but you don't heal entirely. And that might have led to a bit more, does it really power people up or not? And it wasn't ambiguous at all, because it brought... You know, a guy who'd been killed very obviously.
Stabbed repeatedly a lot of times, yeah.
Brought him back from the dead.
I don't know, it's just, it was, I feel like it was scary enough.
Yeah.
If you know what I mean? Like, just the idea of having this guy who's a raving lunatic because he's a cannibal, just stalking everyone in the wilderness, would have been enough, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, so, Yeah, I feel bad because we're focusing in on a problem we have, when actually, overall, I think I personally enjoyed it for the majority of the film. And I thought it was quite a good narrative and it was quite compellingly shot and directed. Actually, it was a woman who directed it. What was her name, Jamie?
Antonia Bird. The original director, whose name I can't remember, was actually fired just after they started making it.
Oh.
And then Robert Carlyle was friends with Antonia Bird because they'd made films previously together. So, yeah. And it's interesting because the film has such a unique style. I wonder what it would have been like had the other director stayed. Would it be quite as strange and...
Yeah. Yeah,
I know what you mean. Like, whose vision was the film ultimately, if you know what I mean?
Yeah, and also
that kind of question.
Someone would have scouted the locations as well. So perhaps it is a bit of a collaboration between, you know, the people who started the project and then Angelo took over. But I haven't seen many of her things. She does a lot of TV direct, or did a lot. She has died, I think. And she did a lot of TV stuff. And I think the film Face has Robert Carlyle in, which I've seen. And we could talk about a different time if we ever do it. But I thought it was interesting because I didn't think this was a particularly like feminine story because like there's only one female character and occasionally like females are referenced, but it's quite a masculine plot as well. It's kind of men surviving in manly jobs.
Also at times somewhat homoerotic.
Yeah, do you reckon?
I mean, yeah, it doesn't really kick in until they're back at the camp and they have a confrontation outside. Robert Carlyle and Guy Pearce, and Guy Pearce's character is like weak at this point because the story starts out with flashbacks to him and he gets behind enemy lines by playing dead and everyone thinks he's a coward. And then he was put under a pile of bodies and the blood from one of his teammates had been dripping.
Playing Halo 4 or something.
Yeah, had been like dripping into his mouth and down his throat, and it gave him, like, suddenly it gave him energy and he pulled himself out from under the bodies and took the enemy stronghold by himself.
Yeah.
And then after the first confrontation with Robert Carlyle, after he reveals who he is, it seems like it's days that Guy Pearce is stuck in that hole with Reich before he caves in and eats him and then escapes. So he's like, they have this little confrontation where Guy Pearce is resisting and Robert Carlyle's saying, you know, I know you're craving it just as much as we all do, and you know the kind of power that it gives you. And he slashes his hand and he's kind of holding it up to his face, like tempting him with the blood. Okay. And it's almost like it's almost as if they could kiss at that point.
Well, it's kind of building as if he's going to kiss his hand and suck the blood or something.
But then,
I wouldn't have quite have read it as homoerotic, though.
Too morbid to
be homoerotic, I think.
There's another scene as well when Guy Pearce is chained up and... what was it that Robert Carlyle has? It does something with his fingers, and then he like sucks. He like sucks them in front of him.
Yeah, but I think it's to do more with tempting someone. It's like if you were trying to tempt someone to break their hunger strike. You know, like he's taking pleasure whenever he indulges in his cannibalism. He enjoys it because he knows it gives him strength, and he wants to convert Guy Pearce's character because he knows he's done it. So
let's not also forget that they die
hugging. That's true.
You got in the missionary position
in a bear hug in a
bound
bear trap
together. Yeah, literally like
I wasn't there until you mentioned they died hugging.
Yeah, only hugging but on top of each other and both penetrated.
Yes, impaled.
Yeah.
Where'd you weigh in on this, Anthony? Homoerotic or no?
I definitely think so. Because essentially it's one man tempting another to, you know, come to...
Something he shouldn't.
Yeah.
And well, see, you guys are reading this like it's a metaphor for being gay, and I read it like, well, if you switch cannibalism for Jaffa cakes, I'm right on the same page as you, Robert Carlyle. So you're saying it's about tempting, sorry.
I don't think it's necessarily a metaphor for being gay. I think it's just that's part of like how you alternately like titillate and disgust certain elements of your audience. It's part of the whole making people feel uncomfortable.
Sure.
Yes.
Well, especially when you have such a what seems to be such a masculine man's film, and then you put like hints of homoeroticism in it. If you know like the horror audience was, at least at the time, I don't know if it is anymore, like predominantly young men. So they're watching this and they may not even realize, but it's like putting them ill at ease because you're seeing two guys getting close and they're going to eat each other. I'm going to go off the rails with this.
It's all right. Now that you've justified it a bit more, I get where you're coming from. It's part of the uncomfortableness of this film.
You have it in with other characters as well. Like Reich is very, he walks around with his shirt open or with his top off, and he's very like washboard abs, muscular, blonde, young guy. And then you've got the scene after, is it Toffler, the young religious guy?
Sure.
Gets injured after he falls down the cliff and he's got a wound on his side, and then they're like treating it and they all go to sleep, and then he wakes up screaming and
he's being licked
because Robert Carlyle was licking him in his sleep.
Well, you got me licked. I give in. You guys are right.
We're not saying, you know, it's definitely there, but
it's subtle.
It's not overt or anything like that.
Yeah, and I don't think it is a deliberate specific metaphor for being gay, but I think there is like deliberate homoeroticism in it, just as either to draw people in or to make people feel uncomfortable.
Yeah,
and depending on who you are, then it's probably like effective either way.
Yeah, well, it isn't overhanded. So there's no bit where he's like made cannibalistic sausage and is like, like, do you fancy some of this?
Like, plus, you know. I think Jamie linked it, the whole story, to kind of like a vampire story.
Yeah,
as well. Yeah. And generally, vampires are very overly sexual and ambiguous. Yeah. So I think that's just something that crosses over as well.
Yeah, it's just part of the seemingly part of the mythology.
Hmm. Well, let's rewind back. You talked about some of the star element there, because it focuses predominantly on Guy Pearce's character going through all of this traumatic experience, and it's really a film of many stuff that is almost formed from anecdotes, almost from like that time period, Civil War horror stories, almost all combined into one thematic thing. Because it starts off with this kind of interesting tale of how Guy Pearce got a medal and also disgraced and sent to quite a rural. He's sent to quite a rural part of California in the snow that is a kind of, like, punishment job. And he got sent there because, like you said, he was he pretended to be dead and got put on a cart of bodies that were taken into enemy territory. And then he kind of... One of the interesting things the film does is it sort of kind of creeps you out because it's, like, disgusting him being on a pile of his comrades who are dead. And it mentions him, you know, having someone's blood dripping into his mouth. And then later on, as they reveal the story, you go, oh, that gave him the power to stop being a coward and take the fort, didn't it? Or did it? You know, like, so it has that interesting kind of macabre story. And it ties that in with the visual metaphor. When he's at the ceremony, everyone's eating these horrible bloody steaks.
Yeah,
and they're so hungry and eating them, and he's kind of put off the idea because he's gone through this horror of a war.
One of my favourite things about this film is how disgusting it is with food.
Like, yeah, just I would say even threw me off meat.
Yeah.
It's not much, it's just kind of a giant piece of meat swimming in its own kind of juices, and just like, oh.
It's the close-ups of people's mouths and the exaggerated sound. Like, it's so gross. And it keeps doing it so that when it comes time that, like, you see Robert Carlyle eating, like, bits of a person, it doesn't even exaggerate that sound, but it just seems gross because you're still remembering that opening scene.
Well, every bit of the film is themed around its messages about hunger, about starvation, about cannibalism, about survival. It's always like there's no part of the film is there just for the sake of it. Everything feeds into the one theme and the messages and moralizing and story. So I thought it was every part of it, though it starts off fairly innocuous, we think nothing much of it. Everything eventually ties into this idea, this concept that eating humans gives you power, and that's a struggle whether you go with it or not.
Yeah, there's very little superfluous with the film, or like unnecessary.
I like that about it. That is a good thing, and like it's a good start as well because it just makes you feel uneasy. It's something, you know, just as simple as, I mean, only Americans would have a plate that is just a steak. Like, do you want to chuck a few potatoes and peas with it? Like, and it fills the whole plate. And I know you've been at war and this is a treat, but come on, guys. That is ridiculous. How can you possibly enjoy that?
A continent of steak and a sea of blood.
Also, you know, Americans, maybe just show the steak to the fire. Maybe that will help. just show it to the fire rather than eating it raw, which seems to be the plan. Anyway.
There is one thing we did miss, and it's the quotes right at the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
And, like, it starts off with a pretty standard kind of Nietzsche quote, which, I don't know, it's kind of almost cliched for films at the moment. And then just all of a sudden the Eat Me comes up anonymous and makes that weird kind of comic arrow twanging noise.
Yeah.
And it's like, wow, how do I take this? It really
sets a good tone for just, it's a strange, like, I think the film is actually tonally consistent all the way through, but it's just an odd tone from the start.
But it's dark comedy sometimes.
Yeah. It definitely doesn't take itself seriously at any point, even how disgusting it gets.
I think that's where you're meant to take the idea of the slightly more paranormal, the kind of, the fact that, what was the word you used, Anthony? Just like the thing about them powering up from eating human flesh? What was the word? Not like paranormal, but like, what's the...
Supernatural,
yeah. So the supernatural element is a little bit out there, because it could have not had that. It could have, like, there's perfectly horrific stories that happen with cannibalism. It's scary enough just anyway. But the supernatural element being there fits with the idea of comedy and lighthearted... Well, it's not lighthearted. The dark comedy kind of makes it okay that they went a little bit, like, sillier. Not sillier, but, you know, more supernatural. I think it fits better with comedy than it would seriousness. But it's, you know, again, it's subtle with the comedy. It's not... It basically has Guy Pearce sent to this, like, rural fort in the mountains of California, where everyone's just slackers and stoners and kind of...
Yeah.
You know, it's just blokes smoking, like, local weed or something. And, like, what is it? We got, like... two Native American characters who work there, but actually a load of dropout, rubbishy soldiers who are not really working. Like a drunken doctor who's actually a vet, and a priest who just seems a bit...
timid.
Who else we got as part of the collection of survivors?
Like Jamie mentioned, the blonde-haired soldier dude.
Yeah, the only one who's a competent soldier, but for some reason he's out here.
I think he's a bit taft.
I love the fact that he's, like, super military, blonde hair, blue eyes, muscular, and his name's Reich. there was a nice little subtext with him there, even though it's, like, you know, pre-Nazi.
I thought he was interesting as well, because while he's alive and going, he actually is one of the few competent characters. Because you think at first he's going to be a bit, like... oh, this guy, he's too much into military and fitness and stuff. And he's confident and cocky a little bit. And you think, it's going to bite you on the backside, possibly literally. And actually, he's actually one of the more successful people. I mean, yes, he gets killed and he flies off a cliff and dies. but
so does everyone else.
A lot of people die in the, you know, and he was doing better than Guy Pearce, who at that same juncture where he was confronted on a clifftop, he just jumps off and hopes a tree will save him by hitting every branch on the way down.
I like the scene where the long sequence where Guy Pearce is stuck in the hole with Reich, and well, Reich's corpse, and Reich just has this grin on his face.
Yeah.
After dying, which is like, it was so uncomfortable and weirdly tense, because there was all, like, even though I knew it was wasn't going to happen, there's still a suspicion of, is he going to wake? Is he going to sit up?
Well, he started when when they both had fallen off the cliff separately. Like Guy Pearce, like, bumps into, you know, his friend who's already died or seemingly has already died, and they end up in this pit, and the Reich does come alive upside down dangling,
yeah,
and start to strangle him. I kind of didn't get it. I was like, wait, is he a zombie? How did he come back to life?
It's one of the, because the film at this point has now introduced that stuff is weird, and then it puts you and Guy Pearce in a hole with Reich, who seemed to come back to life,
yeah,
and is now dead, and it just completely puts you, like, ill at ease, because you're not quite sure what to expect now.
Also, I didn't quite gather, well, why are you strangling Guy Pearce? I mean, he didn't kill you, really. He didn't save you, but I mean, maybe he's just annoyed because he's going to die.
Yeah, with his last, like, dying breath, he's going to kill one of these people he hates that he's been stuck with.
Yeah, you know, if Guy Pearce had been any good, he might have stopped the situation happening and him
might have
being
been
shot or whatever.
Any help whatsoever.
Anyway, I guess, you know, to give a bit more context to this stuff we're talking about, essentially, the story gets going properly. Guy's character has landed in this camp. Essentially, in charge of the camp is Geoffrey Jones. Shame on you, Geoffrey Jones, but we won't judge you on your personal life. Geoffrey Jones is playing a character who's like, what's he, like, slightly old.
Yeah, he's a colonel. He's as in charge of the place as anyone could be.
But he's still kind of, he's, you know, he's having a fairly retired life there.
He's a bit pathetic,
but he'll put up with it. And
he's the Henry Blake of this bizarre MASH setup.
Yeah, it is kind of like that, I guess. He's not too, he knows it's rubbish there, but he probably goes with it because what's better that than being, you know, shot at in a battle somewhere.
Yeah.
So he's a bit shambling and a bit slow, but he, you know, he's willing to do stuff. He seems like a noble enough guy. When trouble comes their way, he's willing to investigate. He's not much of a character, really. He's just there to smash walnuts with a book until later on when he's full strength and he can smash them with his hand. Ooh, creepy. Sorry. Anyway, like, once the story is established, we're at this, like, camp. We get the injection of the character of... What's the name of Robert Carlyle's character?
He's got two. He's Colquhoun and Colonel Ives. He poses as Colonel Ives later on.
Or maybe he is Colonel Ives, I think.
Possibly, yeah. It's, you don't know. Like, yeah.
Well, he's a strange man who comes out of the snow to seek... Well, he doesn't seek help so much as fall down, and they rescue him at their camp. And so once Robert Carlyle gets there, his character is, like, warmed up and rescued, and then he tells them a story which is possibly based in truth, and you know, we're all probably thinking there's something up with this story. We know this is going to get more horrific, but his story's pretty terrible, isn't it? Does anyone have a go at explaining what Robert Carlyle's version of the story is?
He and his wagon train are being led by Colonel Ives, supposedly, who is determined to take them on an easier route, and he gets them lost. And then a storm comes in, they get stranded, and after eating all their animals and their belts, one of them dies, and they decide to cook him, and then they start actually killing each other. And there's two left, there's three of them left, and one of them's Robert Carlyle, and he claims that he ran away before like anything happened to him, and then he leads them back to the cave that he says they were in, like, supposedly where all this happened, and
yeah,
it doesn't quite explain what has been going on in that cave, but it seems like that's his like hideout where he may have been part of a company, or he may have just been capturing people and collecting them in there.
Yeah, well, there's a point where you go, okay, we know his story is going to be partly bogus because we're a clued-in audience, and we're thinking, or we're thinking possibly, or no, when we get to the cannibal's cave, that the guy might still be there, possibly have eaten his wife, and it'd be, you know, like, you know, we could be expecting to come across a villain. But most of us were probably thinking Robert Carlyle. Like, I sensed a trap. And yeah. You're not quite sure how it's going to go about it, but essentially, there's a few things in... Like, Robert Carlyle, if he is just essentially a serial-killing cannibal, like, he is fairly honest about it, because he, from the get-go, he's like, well, we all turn to cannibalism, and I wasn't up for it at first, but I was hungry, so... Yeah. Well, I can eat my friend. It's better than a belt in our own shoes. Like, or eating my dog, because dogs must die and everything.
Yeah.
Go on.
I was just going to say, this is this moment where they find the cave is where the film really kind of kicks off, because it's when Robert Carlyle goes nuts.
I think he looked kind of crazy on the journey, though. Like, when he was wearing the snow goggles, and he has that little funny, yeah. like... priest-style hat or whatever. Yeah. And they have some accidents, and he's behaving quite weirdly. Like you say, but that's when he starts licking someone's wound. And,
His weird little dance and...
Yeah.
Oh, with the hand gestures.
Yeah, and digging in the dirt like a dog to get his knife.
Yeah. And like it comes back to that thing I mentioned earlier. It feels like horror anecdotes of that period.
Yeah,
this is the chapter where so there was this guy who came out of the snow and they rescued him. And he said there was a horrible like guy who'd led them astray and they turned to cannibalism. But there might be survivors. And then when they get there, there wasn't anyone. He was the cannibal and he was there to trap them and kill them. And that's the reveal essentially is after Robert Carlyle, who said they should tie him up, and they do sort of. He essentially starts going into a weird weird trance, doesn't he? And does a little dance. And is behaving weirdly while the competent two of the team, sort of, are exploring what could be his lair. You know, what do you guys make? The story, as he said it, gets revealed that essentially he has eaten everyone from that expedition. Or was, has he always been, a kind of roaming... what was the name of the thing again? Wendigo?
I suppose because the amount of corpses that are there add up to his story. So I suppose you're supposed to believe that he's telling the truth, but he is the Colonel Ives character rather than the character he's pretending to be.
He started eating people long before that.
Did it say that for sure?
Yeah, he tells his actual story later on, and like he learned because he was suffering from tuberculosis and depression and all kinds of other things.
Well, that's right, yeah.
And then he spoke to a Native American scout who told him about the restorative powers of eating people. So he killed the scout and ate him.
But this could have been part of this like collective that were at his cave.
Well, he said it was a year ago.
Oh, okay, so
it was a while ago, and then I think he like. Eight people in between then, and then he became part of this company, and he basically just lured them out into the middle of nowhere and killed them all and ate them.
So he's an experienced serial-killing cannibal, essentially. Yeah. And his motivation goes beyond hunger. So, because the part of the story at this point could have been they did it to survive, but he's got a taste for it now, and it's sort of... But it's not just a taste for it. It has rejuvenative powers and gives him strength and makes it and cures his ailments. And so he's kind of, for some reason, there's this guy who's the first guy to discover that being a cannibal is good for you. So it's kind of odd, in fact, that the whole world hasn't discovered this and haven't set up human farms or something. Because it seems like something that would come to fruition before now.
I mean, yeah, that's his plan, pretty much. Yeah. Just to turn their camp into a community of cannibals who kill selectively, but... Yeah.
I guess that's the thing, is people who have discovered cannibalism's good for you, that doesn't go down well with the moral majority of people.
Yeah.
So it always gets snuffed out or whatever, I guess. But for whatever, that's the concept, is this guy has been tricking people for a while, either to his cave or in various ways, seemingly, because he is a military man, or at least he's been working in the military to get away with it or whatever for longer, perhaps.
I don't know, it doesn't really go into whether or not he is actually military.
Well, the big surprise, because essentially this doesn't go... Most of the people who are investigating the story get killed. So Geoffrey Jones's character is seemingly killed. And like a couple of the other lesser characters are shot or chased after and killed. And essentially, you know, like Guy Pearce's character and Riker come out having realised, hang on, this guy... There's too many bodies, like Anthony said. And they come out, they kind of twig it's a trap. But by then it's too late. Robert Carlyle has killed some of them and they have to chase him. They have this confrontation on a clifftop. And it basically leads to, you know, Reich, Guy Pearce, go off a cliff, dead. In fact, they shoot Robert Carlyle's character and he lives. He gets shot, but he survives because part of the mythology of this Wendigo is that they can survive and that they're, you know, healed by cannibalism and stuff, isn't it?
Yeah.
But they end up anyway, falling off a cliff, blah, blah, blah. They're in a ditch together. One of them's dead. Guy Pearce is still alive and he is traumatically dealing with being frightened and scared of this maniac and also being with his buddy corpse. And then that leads to the compelling moral tale that begins. This is kind of the last section of the film where Guy Pearce survives by eating his friend or his dead comrade. And eventually, he doesn't, you know, it's a big problem because, you know, you'd go crazy, wouldn't you? Guys, how would you guys eat your buddy if you had to?
Well, if we had to, we don't really have a choice.
Yeah, if I was in a hole and...
Oh, thanks.
Almost dying, I guess.
Just kill yourself, you jerk. You're eating one of us. No, okay. Like, anyway, what from this point on, the story is kind of about Guy deciding to eat human flesh to survive, get back to the camp, and then, you know, it's weird. Does anyone want to? Because it's quite the conspiratorial weirdness that happens. It's a really weird switch in the film at this point.
Yeah, Robert Carlyle
turns up and is like, "No, I'm Colonel Ives," and everyone, like, believes him, and he then leads everyone to believe that Guy Pearce is losing his mind, which it looks like he is.
Well, it's not just like that. I mean, he comes back, they kind of hear his story, and they don't know what's happened, but then, you know, the boss of them all turns up, doesn't he?
Yeah.
And they try and investigate and fail to find any evidence of to collaborate the story. And then to blow Guy Pearce's mind, guess who is back, but not as the character he established himself as? Robert Carlyle again. What's he doing?
Yeah, so it's actually kind of... It seems like it's going in the direction of the kind of perfect crime kind of thing, where Robert Carlyle is trying to get away with everything that he's done by setting it all to look like it was Guy Pearce's character who did it all.
Mm. Yeah.
So, I mean, it takes a different direction, obviously, but that's how it plays it for a while.
Yeah, and it's got that, like, wait, we all saw this. How is he getting away with this? Like, it's a bit ridiculous in a sense, because he's managed to... Because what it suggests happens is Robert Carlyle, having not found Guy Pearce, has gone back to his cannibal cave, cleared it out, eaten whoever he felt like, seemingly, based on what happens later in the film, decides to heal Geoffrey Jones up a bit. Like, the passage of time's a bit confusing in the film. You're not sure if it's been days, weeks, or whatever.
The idea is that... Guy Pearce has been in that hole with Reich for a long time before he eats him.
Yeah, starving and frightened, and
because the weather changes while he's down there. So
he's broken his leg as well, isn't he? So
yeah,
that can't heal enough without cannibal saving powers.
Yeah,
yeah. You gotta eat your greens, or more importantly, your humans, to be healthy and well, and heal your broken bone that is completely separated. Somehow, with, like, I think it's like a Wolverine-like quality eating humans, apparently. But this is what happens. Why off-screen, essentially, there's a tidy-up. The guy, like, gets back into his military uniform, has healed up Geoffrey Jones and has told him, right, I want you to come along later on and do horrible stuff to horses to scare everyone and to give away the game a bit. So you hold back, you keep eating leftover corpses of your friends, you'll join me, we'll start a whole new life as cannibalized, you know, superheroes. We'll do it by convincing everyone that Guy Pearce is actually the baddie. It's a weird plan.
It is a weird plan, considering the end game is to actually convert Guy Pearce, and that it doesn't actually matter what anyone thinks about what happened.
Yeah, because essentially, you're either going to be killed or join him.
Yeah, I think it's to make him see that it's hopeless, and that he may as well join, because they've got him head off at like every turn.
Yeah,
like anything he tries to do.
Yeah, they did send out the Native American woman to call in the cavalry. So there's still her.
Yeah.
Actually, she was... She had a few odd moments that I didn't quite know how to grasp. Like, first of all, I think Guy Pearce comes up to her because she's really the only one who knows anything about the Wendigo legend.
Yeah.
And she's just very cold with him. And I don't really know how to take that. Did she think he's the Wendigo? Or
she distrusts or something.
She knows he's eaten human flesh as well. And yeah, she basically says...
She basically says
the only way out is they both have to die.
Also, then, maybe she's aware of his story of him surviving. And if she knows about him, like, getting blood in his mouth, maybe she's suspicious of him. Or just maybe distrust generally, because she's, you know, knows about demons and stuff that exist.
Yeah.
So that's fine. And then the second kind of moment she has is right at the end. I'm skipping when everyone's dead. And it kind of looks like she could be the saviour for Guy Pearce right at the end, but then she just kind of runs away.
Well, she more...
Which I guess is understandable.
She sort of discovers them, doesn't she, when everyone's dead. And she kind of just goes... She seems to knowingly leave. Mm. She leaves as if... Well, my plan to let everyone die has succeeded, and now I will escape. Like, she doesn't seem... Like, there's something knowing that I think isn't clarified enough by the film to her. Because she's essentially correct in that Wendigos exist, and she warns the people of them. But she's never really meant to be taken seriously. It's never a question of, well, you have to believe me. She just works there, believes it, and seems to understand what has happened when it has all gone down. But leaves. She's, you know, she's insignificant in the end because she hasn't do anything about it, you know.
Mm.
Anyway, so it's quite a weird plan if you think back at it.
Yes.
But as it happens, it's really exciting and it kind of blows your mind a bit because you're like, huh? And then you twig what's going on and you go, oh, it's a bigger conspiracy and he's been he's recruited. A new member who he thought was dead, and like Geoffrey Jones, is he going to be an even worse baddie? But then it suggests that Geoffrey Jones' character is having moral problems with it, even though he's seen the proof of it, the healing power.
He doesn't
really want to go along with it because it's horrific.
Well, I think what happens is because Robert Carlyle talks about how. It's like a drug. Like, you high when you eat it, and then you start craving more, and you come down again. Hmm. And I think when Geoffrey Jones...
Yeah, it wasn't necessarily a choice for Geoffrey Jones's character.
No, he was just fed it, and it brought him back to life, and now he's got this craving. And when he's eaten human flesh, he feels great. And then he comes down again and realizes what he's become.
Hmm.
Which is why he says to Guy Pearce, you know, you have to do me a favour, you have to kill me, because I can't, like, I can't keep doing it.
At his most sober, he wants out. He'd rather be dead than going along with Robert Carlyle's...
So then Guy Pearce kills him in an incredibly gruesome way.
My God,
He's not even... He doesn't even, like, mercy kill him. He just slits his throat and lets him bleed to death.
In fairness, he had come back and killed, you know, some people...
Yeah.
Himself and horses and stuff, so you know, he deserved to not have just a. I get they were just, you know, he was all he, even though he'd been forced into it initially, he's still gone along with it. So
we did, we have skipped over with that one of the best scenes of the film when Robert Carlyle stabs Guy Pearce like fatally, and then they cook Knox in a stew.
Yeah.
And they sit in a civilized living room in front of the fire, eating human flesh stew.
Big onions.
Talking.
Like, they seem to not chop their onions up enough.
And they...
And carrots.
And Guy Pearce just sitting over it, bleeding out of his mouth. And he looked so hungry and dead. Yeah. That, like, it was such a hilariously disgusting scene. And then when he gives in and starts shoveling chunks of it in his mouth, it's just, it's horrible.
Like one of the films we've done for a podcast before, the film Popeye, where he doesn't like spinach, but he begrudgingly eats it because he needs it to power him up.
Oh, memories.
But yeah, so, you know, the spinach of cannibalism gives Guy Pearce the healing factor, and but still, he's chained. He has to overcome two things. His actual physical foe in front of him, who is a nutjob cannibal, and he has to fight the urge to become a full cannibal himself, you know. Because it could be that it takes him over, and I could have seen the film ending with he defeats Robert Carlyle's character, but then ends up being a cannibal within this fort and decides to be the next one. Like, becomes the next killer.
Passing of the torch.
That's exactly what I thought was going to happen, because it seemed like it was really signposting it.
Yeah.
Especially as the whole thing is a kind of metaphor for just survival, if you know
and
what
it,
I mean.
It keeps playing on the idea of his cowardice, and Robert Carlyle saying, you know, wussing out and not joining me is just more cowardice. Like, it would be braver to embrace it. Hmm. But then you've got, like, the final redemption when they do end up in the bear trap together, when Robert Carlyle says, you know, whichever one of us dies first can survive, the other one can survive by eating the one who dies first.
Yeah.
And then he dies, and he leaves Guy Pearce with that choice, and then Guy Pearce just allows himself to die rather than give in, even though, you know, the guy he hates so much is right there. He still holds fast to that, which is, even though he dies horribly, still he has, like, some
moral victory.
Yeah.
Which it's a bittersweet redemption, because he still, he has to have the courage to not become a monster. And then and in doing so, he has to decide to die rather than survive.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to go, considering how horrible it is.
Which is odd, because essentially the goal of life is to survive.
Yeah. Well, it's just such a lovely bittersweet, moral victory, but, like, you know,
it's such a cruel ending that it's funny.
Yeah.
Because it's just relentless.
But they've also, this is, you know, this happens after they have quite a violent fight where I think they get stabbed stabbed with, like, pitchforks and multiple stab wounds and proper, like, hacking at each other. Like,
I think
so ridiculous.
I like the fight so much because it wasn't a Hollywood showdown. It was just two guys falling around the place and smashing and stabbing each other with whatever they could find.
Yeah, it was
fairly
low-key for a fight, I suppose.
And
even though how gruesome and horrible it was.
It all looked like it really hurt.
Very visceral.
Yeah, I remember at the end, at that point you think, well, you're both so stabbed now. Neither of you surviving unless you continue to be cannibals. And I think that even more suggests, okay, at least one of them is going to succeed, and we're going to have a cannibal at the end. And the way that it gets, and even though it doesn't, neither of them become a cannibal at the end, there's just that little hint of the cannibalism could continue, because the big boss of all these guys, the guy from The West Wing, I can't remember his real name.
John Spencer, I think his character is the actor.
So John Spencer's character turns up and is looking around and doesn't discover all of the corpses. So he manages to stumble into the room where the big cauldron of stew is, and very tentatively is smelling it. And you're like, don't drink it. We know you're going to. Don't.
Yeah.
And he does. And he just seems to enjoy it. And you go, no, he's going to be the next one.
The best thing about that, again, is the exaggeration of, like, eating and stuff. Like, the sound of him slurping it is really loud. And then he does that thing that I hate people do, where he goes, mmm. Just because people who vocally eat.
It would have been funny if he'd have tasted it and gone, oh,
That's
that
horrible.
That needs more salt or something. Yeah. Like, oh. And he just tipped it all away. Like, that is the most disgusting. Just utterly. I thought it was an interesting choice, actually, for Robert Carlyle's character when he comes in as the army guy. He's a vegetarian, and it's like, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, veggie, is it? Secretly, I think all vegetarians are cannibals, really.
Yeah. I thought as well, after the, like, because he was there when they were fighting each other, he just didn't witness it. And then when they fall into the bear trap and the film ends, what happened when they found them like that in their intimate position? Yeah, nailed together.
I suppose it goes back to the kind of sort of legendary story then that Rich was talking about, where, you know, that it becomes a story in itself, just kind of turning up at a remote cabin and then just finding two corpses in a weird position, and then you don't know how to explain it, or
yeah, and maybe it becomes kind of folklore, and maybe the story of someone discovering this army base where everyone had either turned on each other, or there'd been lots of weird murders and people had been cooked as well, and then the story is born out of speculation, or you know, bloke from the West Wing is now the next guy. Like, that's what I was thinking. Surely he notices his hair is coming back with a better luster, and he's feeling a bit, his lungs aren't as knackered and he's less wrinkly, and he's like, that stew was awesome, what was in that? He thinks it's beef and he dies and doesn't become a cannibal.
they find the bodies and they just think, man, these guys are into some kinky stuff.
It's extreme. But then, you know, there is the Native American woman has wandered off, seemingly knowing the truth, or at least speculating on the truth. I don't know. Yeah, but it is that culmination of legendary stories and anecdotes that are horrific coming together in one overarching, the myth of the Wendigo, which is all... It's a really, from beginning to end, it is all about this myth having a filmic version where we go, okay, the concept of the myth is being either altered or being portrayed as... Because essentially the myth is about men turning to cannibalism and turning them into demons. Yeah. And in this case, he doesn't physically become a demon, but it does do everything else but turn him into a physical monster.
He pretty much becomes a monster.
An endless lust for human... Like, it's a craving that never ends. It is ravenous, his want of human... like. To eat humans, essentially, and that is the myth, exactly, like that. It's about having this curse that means you can never stop, it's never you get your fill, it's like a vampire, you have to keep going that way.
I'm not really a fan of vampires, like movies, stories, whatever, partly because it's been so neutered and watered down over the years. Like, vampires have gone from being monsters to being weirdly angsty, sexy things, and it's just...
You don't get sexy cannibals, usually. Hannibal is, like, the coolest, coolest cannibal going, and he's not sexy.
I like that this film did have, like, a sexual and a homoerotic element to it, but it also still... It took the vampire thing and made it monstrous again.
I think it's because the concept that's scary is when men turn on each other in survival, and it's about man's evil rather than a sort of... There was the slightly more like supernatural element to it, but the scariest part is wilderness, survival, people turning on people, and this myth that maybe cannibalism is an addiction that can turn you evil and crazy.
Yeah, and that's kind of why I didn't like the supernatural thing, because man versus man, nature versus nature, is the kind of overarching theme of it, and it didn't really need the supernatural element.
He could have just been a straight-up serial killer who was a cat. Like, he could have been like Hannibal, who maybe even thinks it gives him powers when it perhaps doesn't.
Yeah,
they should have at least ambiguity, shouldn't they?
Yeah, definitely. And it's just the kind of balance of... it's natural to want to survive and to kill people and to feed yourself. But
well, it's not that it's natural also, to kill people.
No, but it is. But in our society, we've come to not do that.
Good on us. Yeah, it's part of nature, isn't it? You know, killing to survive. And it would be more compelling if they hadn't made it supernatural. And they didn't have like little things where characters were coming back for the pure drama of it rather than sense. Because really, Robert Carlyle's character could have got more of his way if he'd have just not revealed himself so obviously. Because there comes a point where no one's believing Guy Pearce, and then Robert Carlyle's like, now that we're alone, I will totally reference all of the stuff we did and that no one else will admit to. Plus, when Robert Carlyle, it's just a side thing, really. Robert Carlyle looked so much funnier and crazier when he was like he was like a bigger beard and was like crazy priest wild man. And then when he comes back, it is a nice change when he's like a clean, sort of tidier looking soldier who isn't willing to admit to anything that's gone on.
I wish he'd kept the goggles.
They did look brilliant, didn't they?
That was a fantastic look.
Just a bit of blood in the teeth and beard, goggles, mad looking hat, worn out goggles. Clothes.
Yeah, because the goggles are so big that they're just looking in different directions, so they just made him look insane.
Yeah. He behaves more like a madman as the first character he's being, or himself. Because he's more sinister later when he's like a military man. And for some reason, the only thing he does that's a bit crazy is he draws like a red cross on his head in blood for no reason.
Yeah, that was great.
Just to be scary.
Full on Charles Manson.
Yeah. He's like more sinister then. But I like the dancing crazy man who'd dug up a knife that he'd buried to kill these guys. I thought that was more like, I liked the craziness of that. Rather than this kind of Ra's al Ghul type, I will survive forever on the blood of the innocent kind of, you know, business. Not that Ra's al Ghul's a cannibal. He's got his Lazarus pits. Our crazy guy has his stew. Human stew. Yeah, so, like, conclusions, thoughts. At the end, summings up, ratings. Anyone got any suggestions for a rating? What recipe of human flesh?
what cryptozoological animal is it?
I guess, but it kind of has to be the one that the whole film's about, I guess.
Yeah.
It's slightly implausible, maybe. Myth, but compelling.
I don't know. It's some kind of food. Some kind of food that is presented in a kind of ugly way. Like it looks really unappetizing, like hummus or something. You're like, ugh, that looks like sick. And then you taste it, and it actually tastes quite nice, and you can get past the visuals.
I don't know if it did. I don't think this film looked horrible to begin. I mean, it looks but I thought it looked appetizing. And then when you taste it, you kind of get a second, like it kind of surprises you, like more than confounds you. Do you know what I mean?
Maybe like. Blue cheese or something like
blue cheese.
You taste it, and at first it smells like mold, and you taste it, and you're like, ugh, this is really nice. What?
Okay.
It's such a strange taste.
And it looks unappealing because it's horrifically rotten.
Yeah.
Right. So it's a kind of disgusting cheese that's actually very tasty.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a very strange film. I can't. There's not really anything else like it.
No.
It doesn't seem like it was made for anyone other than just to make it and tell the story. Like it wasn't made. Yeah.
It seemed like it was made by people who liked these kind of rural stories of like wild America. You know, it was a passion project about mythology and survivalism.
It's a very kind of pure film. It doesn't seem like it was marketed. It doesn't seem like it was like producers interfering and you know.
And for the most part, it was very well directed and well told and well acted. Like everyone did a good job. Every character felt, even the ones that were smaller characters with very little to do. The priest guy, when he was like hammering in a stake for some reason, and actually he was decorating with like an antlered skull.
That wasn't a different character. That was David Arquette, who was just the mad little stoner.
That's right.
I agree with you that the acting was really good all around for everyone. Guy Pearce, bit of a wet blanket.
I think that's the point.
He's
like,
a coward.
I got that. Like they were kind of, he's supposed to be the character that you sympathise with, so they give him less personality, so you can kind of project your own onto it. Yeah. But that's, I don't know, that never really works for me, because then that's just a bland character.
I was a bit surprised at Guy Pearce playing such a straight character.
Yeah, especially for Guy Pearce as well.
Yeah, he does play, I mean, this was fairly early in his, like, big career. But, like, yeah, he normally plays slightly odder, like, weirder characters. He's kind of become like Johnny Depp before he outstayed his welcome as like the weird guy.
I agree with you, Anthony. I think all of the little parts and the little characters, and even Robert Carlyle, brilliantly telling, like, that you got what their characters are about from just a little scene of them doing something, behaving, speaking.
Yeah.
Whether it's the doctor or the priest or the sort of daft guy. You know, like, they all, every character had something going for them. And with Guy Pearce, because he's the protagonist, it's a bit weird that he's too much of a wet blanket. Like you say, he's a coward in character, but he seems to win by being a coward. And, like, he survives, but his win is even pacifistic. Like, giving up is his win, and he's a little bit, you can't fully root for him because you go, oh, come on, grow up a bit.
It could almost be that, like, that's the point. He's, like, the one who decides to remain, like, human, but at the same time, that makes him, to the end, kind of weak and pacifist, and Robert Carlyle is the one with the real passion, even though he's the villain. He's the one with, like, zest for life, whereas, like, Guy Pearce just allows himself to die.
Yeah, but part of the story of Guy Pearce's character is once he's pitchforking his nemesis, you should be like, well, you've crossed the line from coward now to hero. Yeah. And I do think I agree with you, Anthony. He was, if not holding back something, he portrayed it in a slightly less, like, what do you think he did wrong? Like, because it feels like he could have been a bit more compelling.
That he should have been, I think, I kind of feel like he should have been a much more tortured character, and I don't think that came across as well as the director perhaps thought it did.
Yeah, well, I think it's a character who's been through a lot, because he's survived, he gave up, he's a coward, but then he was buried under his comrades, and he survived, and he got stuck in a terrible job, and then he had to deal with a crazy serial killer, and had to survive in a pit and then he had to eat his friend, and then he was chained up, and then he was forced to, you know, do more and more horrible things. And so he should have been a bit more tortured, rather than he's got a limp now and he's a little bit, he calls out a little bit and he still sounds pathetic, and you go, come on, guy, you're a madman. If you can't break free from the chains, you can at least come up with something craftier than just calling after someone.
Or it could just be a fact that everyone else was so perfect that he just then stands out then as a sore thumb because of that.
Yeah. But I didn't feel myself going, oh, this is boring at any point.
No. Not at all. This is a good film.
Yeah. I think that's it. Is it surprisingly good? Like Jamie's sort of cheese metaphor. It's the sort of thing where you go, okay, this cheese is kind of, but people become massive cheese fiends, and I for one wouldn't have expected to enjoy this film as much as I did. I thought it was a really good western-y horror film.
Yeah, for me, I suppose it's something, a similar thing, but do you remember those, like, chocolate bars that you had? I think they were like Willy Wonka chocolate bars, and they had, like, the popping candy in them.
Yeah, and like jelly beans.
And it's just the kind of, this is odd. I could see why. Yeah. I mean, they're both sweets, fair enough. But to put them together, I mean, they're such different things. And yet you put them in your mouth and it's not good. It's not bad. It's just really different and odd.
I agree. But then I really like those weird jelly bean popping candy chocolate bars.
At the end, I think it's going to come down to personal taste.
Yeah, you either go, what was that? That was too much weirdness.
Yeah.
Let's separate out the jelly beans from the chocolate and enjoy them differently.
It is definitely, like, it is the perfect example of a cult movie.
Because it's about a cult, in a way. Like, yeah. The cult of cannibalism that gets foiled. Yeah, it is, it's an acquired taste. Maybe like human flesh. It's not for everyone, but no, it's a really good film. I think. And it, I just enjoyed its uniqueness, because I haven't seen that story done to death. Like, I've seen survivalist things, and I've seen, like, I like the way it was done. It was directed well, it looked good. The music was compelling for me. I don't think that was a factor that scared me off. And even though elements of the plot are a little bit, oh yeah, like, I see.
Yeah.
Like, they're a bit dubious. But I really liked the little, the overall anecdote, and I liked the mythology it took, and I liked the way it presented it. So, in a sense, it was like getting a good meal, like a good roast dinner, that you thought, I'm going to like this, but you actually taste it, and you kind of go, oh, this is why it's gourmet, four-star restaurant stuff. This isn't just any roast dinner, this is like, you know. But at the same time, maybe you've paid too much, like, and you could have had a homemade one. I don't know. I'm struggling this week with a food metaphor, but maybe it's like a surprising meal that you thought you might like, but it was actually better than you thought as well, and yet at the end you're left questioning it. I don't know. I'm not sure. I think you guys did better than me.
I see what you're going. Maybe it's like the meal had like fancy trimmings, and you're like, "Well, that's not going to make a difference, is it?" But then you experience it, and it I see what you mean.
Where did you get this meat?
I was going to say something like gold flakes in vodka.
I was going to say something much lamer. I was going to say like, "Well, why does Viennetta look as fancy as it does?" But then those little ridges and curls on the side just make that slice of ice cream much better.
That's weird, actually, because that would be where I would be an alternate viewer of this film, because I think Viennettas are fancy looking. They look like, oh, get me, you know, you're meant to have them at the sort of shindig you'd have with an ambassador. Maybe you'd get some Ferrero Rocher after that as well. But you get your Viennetta, and even though they're only like a pound in Iceland or whatever, like, you feel fancier eating them. But I actually find them not that enjoyable.
No,
I think that could also happen with this film. You taste it, and you go, that was horrible and stupid.
It is, I think, I can see why it's not forgotten. It has got quite a following, but it was never huge, because for people who don't like, you know, darker films or horror or whatever, this would just be abrasive and unpleasant.
Maybe, but it's really good. It's got good tension. It's like an interesting take on a mythology, and I think that's okay. Some people are going to have a roast dinner and they're never going to be able to get over the fact that they don't like parsnips and swede. And I'm like, well, I didn't think I liked parsnips and swede, but you've just caramelized them just enough, and that is perfect. Well done. 3 stars, some funny bits. Yeah.
I don't know if we're talking about food or the film anymore.
Neither do I.
Either way, I'm starving.
Yeah.
I'm ravenous. Yeah, so let's all go and have a kebab.
Of dubious knowing meat.
Yeah.
Always. That's every kebab.
Every meat should be mystery meat.
We may all be cannibals and not know it already.
Anyway, I think that concludes the podcast, guys.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Stick a fork in it, it's done. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.